It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Keith Caulfield, and I am the co-director of charts at Billboard. Joining me, as always, is Billboard.com senior editor Katie Atkinson. Hello, Katie.
Hi there, Keith.
How are you?
Doing well, because today we have a little coming around again segment with Hanson's Mbop.
Mbop, mbop, doo, mbop, doo, da, bop, boo, da. Oh, man, that's such
you'll
an
never alarm. Forget those lyrics.
It'll be with you for the next 2 days. Well, you'll hear all about Mbop in just a second, because the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop.
Today on the show, we've got Coming Around Again with Billboard.com senior associate editor Andrew Unterberger. Andrew will be discussing the 20th anniversary of Hanson's classic Mbop single, along with Billboard contributor Dan Weiss and spin writer Anna Gotza. So stay tuned for that in just a few moments.
Mbop. But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on iTunes so you won't miss an episode, and give us a rating or review while you're at it. If you have any questions for us, feel free to tweet us at Keith_Caulfield or KT Atkinson. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, and why the heck would you not, visit iTunes.com/Billboard Podcasts.
So I kind of can't believe that it's been 20 years since Mbop.
It just went by, and just in an Mbop, it's gone.
In an Mbop, it's gone.
I don't know. It ages me, I suppose.
Cause I still want to think of them as being the exact same age as they were when Mbop came out.
Katie and I were looking at the ages of the Hanson brothers now, and I'm like, they're all still incredibly young.
The oldest one is 36, Isaac.
He's actually 22.
Well, yeah. In real life, is that what you're saying?
He's only 22 now. He was a 2-year-old on the drums,
right?
20 years ago.
That's Zach on the drums, obviously, Keith.
Yeah. No, but it is crazy how it's been 20 years. Because I'm, you know, the chart guy, I looked up, of course, Mbop's chart history. It spent 3 weeks at number one on the Hot 100 back in 1997, spent 22 weeks on the chart, and it was the first of three top 20 hits from Hanson's debut album. Not their debut album. They had two top 10 hits from their
breakthrough
debut
album.
Their breakthrough album. Mbop. And then they had I Will Come to You. But man, that Mbop.
But Mbop.
Well, we're going to hear all about Mbop in just a second.
Yes, we will, because now here is Coming Around Again.
Hello and welcome to Coming Around Again, Billboard's podcast celebrating notable anniversaries in the music world. Today we're going to be discussing Hanson's Mbop, which was released as a single 20 years ago last week and became one of the most iconic pop songs of the 90s pretty much instantly. So we're going to talk to a couple Hansonites in this episode about the band and their signature song. First up, we got my former co-writer at Spin and Styles Magazine and current freelancer extraordinaire, Dan Weiss. What's up, Dan?
Hey there. What's up?
Hey, so we actually had you basically pulling double duty on the Hanson beat last week for the extended Billboard family. You wrote something for Stereo Gum, kind of your own 20-year remembrance of the song and kind of what makes it interesting. And you also wrote something for Billboard, Billboard.com, about the 11 best songs that the band did that aren't Mbop. So we're going to talk about both of those at least a little bit. But first, I wanted to take it back to 1997 and ask you, Do you remember, you know, generally what your first impressions were of the band when you heard them? You know, they kind of came out of nowhere at the beginning of 1997. The single was released in April, and I think by May it was number one. So what was it like for you at the time? What were your opinions of the band, you know, right away?
Right. I mean, I don't even know if I could, like, trust my opinion at the time, because I'm sure, like, as, like, a kid, like, I probably thought it was, like, corny or something. I don't think I had, like, a very, like, strong opinion of it. I just remember, I mean, at the time it felt like everything that came out in 1997 was out of nowhere. Like, you know, Smash Mouth was out of nowhere, Chumbawamba was out of nowhere. But what set Hanson apart was just that earnestness. You know, I mean, they were kids, they just had this, like, sincere, emotional, like, completely devoid of irony thing, going on that sort of, I guess, like, made people, listen up and really feel, I don't know, like, I guess that they kind of made it clear that there was a void in pop at the time of this kind of just totally, like, earnest, heart-throbby, I guess at the time this is what passed for teen pop too, but yeah. I guess we'll talk later about what that became.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we talked a little bit about this on the podcast last week. We were talking about the Third Eye Blind self-titled album and about just how kind of 1997 nobody really knew what was going on in rock, and that kind of extended to pop too, because for a few years there in the mid-90s, like, rock basically was pop. You know, there were pop stations that, you know, were basically playing alternative rock as their core musical format. And then, yeah, you talked about this in your piece about how Hanson kind of came, and, you know, even though other bands were sort of going in the pop direction, they still kind of had one foot in the sort of irony of the alt-rock 90s, and they were still trying to be a little bit edgy and kind of feign at, like, a greater, like, underground purpose. But here comes Hanson, and, you know, they hit immediately with this absolutely, like, gigantic pop hook, and then the chorus that, you know, as it probably goes down as, if not the, like, one of the biggest and most instantly recognizable courses of the entire decade, really. And it sort of changes the direction of where pop music was going at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's not even like that someone like Matchbox 20 was trying to, like, be cool or something, but there was just this dark undercurrent with, like, virtually everything in the 90s, just because people were so accustomed to grunge and to just to sort of having negativity be a lasting thing in the culture, and I guess because the counterculture kind of became the culture at the time, like, you know, everything alternative that was, you know, not visible in the 80s became like everything that was visible in the 90s. So with Hanson, it was weird because they still looked very alternative. Like, they're these long-haired kids wearing flannel who are teenagers, and, like, they could have easily been in, like, the Lemonheads or something. But then they're singing this song that sounds like, you know, like the Jackson 5 or something like Steve Miller or Jackson Brown. Like, it was just this classic rock pop band.
Yeah, you had the line in your piece, which actually I think this was the piece you wrote for Billboard, but you called the quintessential Hanson sound was Jackson Brown meets Jackson 5, which I was actually kind of jealous I didn't think of myself, because it's pretty right on.
You know, it's funny, someone pointed that out to me, and, like, I said it because of those two things, but I didn't even notice the Jackson thing, even though normally I do play off things like that, but I didn't actually notice that at the time.
It worked out for the best, certainly. And your piece, your Stereo Gum Anniversary piece, kind of gets at, I think, the most interesting thing about the song, which we've already sort of touched on, which is that, you know, it was this obviously massive pop song, and I think it's probably one of the first songs people even think of when they think of pop from this era. But it was kind of like indie and alternative in its construction. I was, you know, watching some old videos of theirs, including the Umbop video, and I was shocked by, like, yeah, how baggy their clothes were, and how they, in one video I was watching, there was an MTV interview, and the interviewer asked them, like, what their favorite bands or the artists they really liked were, and the first they mentioned were the Spin Doctors and Blues Traveler.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, so there's that on the one hand, and then there was also the fact that, like, despite the upbeatness and poppiness of the chorus hook, the lyrics are actually, like, very kind of dark and you know, almost fatalistic in a way. And you compared them in your piece to artists like Typo Negative and Mount Eerie, which I think not a lot of people usually put in conjunction with Hanson. But why don't you talk about that a little bit, why you see the lyrics of that song kind of being in more of that, like, super heavy vein than people maybe know from having heard it a couple times.
Right. Well, it, it's interesting because, like, with kids, I feel like there's something about the fact that they were kids that kind of gets at this, like, this simplicity that an adult might not be able to, like, put into such a concise statement. But the kids have a way of kind of just surprising you with saying something that's, like, so simple and profound or something. And this song was sort of, like, an extension of that. Like, it's funny because they almost played down in a lot of ways that they were kids, and the, mm-hmm. the album itself, like, you know, as I said in the piece, like, it sounds more like Blues Traveler or the Wallflowers or something, which were clearly big influences on them, you know, these sort of, like, adult rock bands at the time, but yeah, the sentiment itself, I mean, yeah, they're talking about death, they're talking about things going away. It's so bizarre, you know, because, hey, I guess it's both, like, it's unusual and not unusual, because, yeah, at the time there were lots of bands on the radio who were talking about death, and, you know, and we had just seen, you know, like, we had lost Kurt Cobain, who was a huge rock icon, and just lots of, you know, death was always sort of in the conversation in 90s rock, but the way that they came at it was from this highly uncynical place, like, this really, you know, it's weird to call it, like, a positive place, but it was very... you know, hang on to what you've got, really care about it in the moment. So, yeah, it's really negative to put it that way, to open your song saying that you're only going to have a couple of relationships in this life that will last. But, you know, the exuberance of the chorus and everything, and also the genius of turning this bit of onomatopoeia, you know, whatever, like, it's to... which started out as a backing vocal, apparently. Like, they were trying to write some kind of backing vocal for, I guess, another song, and they realized this was its own thing entirely. To actually give that a meaning inside the song, that's really, really brilliant.
I remember seeing interviews with them after the fact, well after the fact, where they kind of expressed irritation that more people didn't understand the meaning of the song or didn't understand what an mbop was or anything like that. But this version of mbop, whose 20th anniversary we're celebrating last week, it wasn't the first version of the song. It wasn't even the first version of the song to be commercially released. There was a version of the song that appeared on, like, a demo album of theirs that was released a year before, and it was actually called mbop, the demo collection, and the indie album, I guess. And, you know, the song, it's very different in a lot of ways. It's much slower. It's much... you know, it's much less polished, obviously. And, you know, the Dust Brothers, who were the production duo behind the Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique and Beck's Odelay, they came along and they really kind of snazzed it up a little bit, and they did a whole bunch of things to it. Like, you know, they added some cowbell, and they added some kind of, like, 90s wiki scratch effects, and some of that hasn't dated so well. But I think the most important thing that they did with the song is that they actually made the lyrics less identifiable. Like, they made it harder to understand what they were actually saying in the song. Because, you know, Taylor Hanson's singing kind of sped up, and his enunciation isn't great to begin with. So, you know, when you're talking about the first lines of that song being so dark, you know, I heard that song, I don't know, several hundred, maybe thousand times in 1997. I could not have told you to save my life what those lyrics actually were. And so I think that the Dust Brothers actually did Hanson a favor by making their song harder to understand. Does that jibe with your kind of opinion of the song?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, the most notable difference, yeah, between those versions is that the earlier one was slowed down, or it was slower, and the Dust Brothers just helped them realize that even though this is, like, a kind of, like, morbid song, that it is a pop song and deserves to be upbeat and have this breakbeat under it and scratching and stuff. And I think that, I mean, this is probably, like, a pattern, especially around, like, 1997, where, you know, like you mentioned, like, Third Eye Blind, I mean, that song, like, you know... mentions, like, it talks about using drugs and crystal meth the way that, like, a Tarantino movie would, but you know, he's sort of rapping it almost so fast that people would also miss that if he didn't so, like, gleefully discuss it in interviews. And with Hanson, yeah, I mean, he had this high voice. I don't know if it, like, officially had, like, changed yet from puberty or whatever, but it was a little difficult to make out the words themselves as opposed to the syllables and yelps that he was, you know, making. And yeah, I think it benefited from that a lot, because, yeah, it's just this, you know, I mean, I think to some people it was a negative, you know, this mindlessly happy tune that annoyed the shit out of them, but yeah, it was Yeah, I mean, any song, I think, benefits from sounding, you know, commercially, from sounding more like a pop song of the day or whatever. But also, like, musically, you know, those chords are, like, kind of happy chords. Like, there's a really sad, you know, tinge to them, but for the most part, like, they worked really well with, like, a bouncy, funkier beat.
For sure, yeah. And you and I have kind of talked about this as well, that, you know, even though Hanson were kind of in more of in an alternative mold than I think people probably remember, their massive success and just what a huge runaway hit this album was, kind of signaled to you know the pop infrastructure that people were ready for music like this again. And so but between them and the Spice Girls, who were the other really big pop group in 1997, they kind of, you know, it was sort of year zero for pop music all over again, because, you know, the alternative era had sort of run its course, and now we were ready for the next big thing, which of course ended up being, you know, the TRL era with boy bands and Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, and then the female pop stars like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera. You don't see Hanson necessarily being part of that lineage, right? But you do think that you know it was made possible because of their success.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess, like, in a technical sense, they're part of it. It's weird because they're the ultimate, like, transitional act for this, because yeah, like I said, like, they look like, you know, like the Lemonheads or like Nirvana fans or something, but the, you know, they didn't really get, like, you know, any particular haircut or anything for the Oombop video. They just kind of put on what looks very much like the clothes they wore to the set.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and you know, it sounds like, from what you can hear from the original Oombop demo, like, not a lot was changed from their original thing other than just cleaning it up, making it faster. Like, it wasn't, you know, Dust Brothers didn't, like, completely change what they wore so much. And the album itself, even though it has, like, turntable scratching and stuff, it's very much like a roots rock record. It sounds like someone who's listening to Blues Traveler. But the thing is, at the time, this was, like, the closest thing to teen pop, you know, before Britney and Backstreet and everything came in. So it's really jarring to listen to it now and hear, like, I guess, like, I don't know if there's actual, like, Hammond B3 on the album, but it sounds like, it seems like there is, and to just have those these things of, like, Blues Traveler, Counting Crows, like, things that were sort of on adult rock radio at the time, that this is considered a teen sensation, and especially when you listen to, you know, the stuff that they're making now, it makes a lot of sense that this is what they've become, you know, sort of a soul rock band. And I mean, you could, if you were going to, If you squint a little bit, you can see that that Hootie and the Blowfish were maybe, like, the real predecessors of this, but Hanson were the first ones who made it sort of a boy band thing.
Yeah, they weren't putting Darius Rucker in, like, the teen beat magazines, I don't think, for better or worse.
Right.
So yeah, you know, obviously they had, you know, maybe a shorter cultural moment in the sun than people would have expected, but I'm curious. I was looking this up, you know, before we talked today, and if you had to guess, how many hits on the Hot 100 would you say that Hanson had total throughout their career? Now, not top 10 hits or top 40 hits, but just anything on the Hot 100. What number would you
anything
guess?
Anything on the Hot 100. See, I haven't actually looked at the charts in it, but I know they've got, like, a pretty fierce cult. So I would say, like, that cult's probably given them maybe, like, 4 or 5.
It's only 3, actually. They only, which for me seems an absurdly low number. I mean, obviously, Mbop was their biggest hit, but I remember that album lasting a year and a half, just still being everywhere. I remember, actually, even though they weren't part of the TRL era as we think of them, I remember the very first episode of that show, which I think was only called Total Request at that time. That Weird, which was like the third or fourth single off that album, was the number one video on that debut episode. So it's surprising to me that they left such a kind of a small thumbprint in terms of the charts of the era. But
yeah, it's weird because I think it's hard to not, like, to actually remember them as some kind of, like, I don't think they're actually considered a flop, even though their sales would sort of say that, because they've had such a smooth transition to still, like, they retained an indie fan base, and they took control of their career so quickly, like, so, like, really, really early in the 2000s, they were already recording on their own label, and they just definitely, you know, did not want to be part of, I guess, the industry country stuff and compromises and such, like, from an early... And the fact that they were already making these indie recordings as kids anyway probably helped the fact that they felt they could do it on their own. So I think that they kind of opted out before they could actually fail, in a sense.
Yeah.
And they were already doing things on their own terms, like, so quickly. Like, it was only really the first album and maybe the second one where they were having to deal with what I guess, like, unimaginable pressures of a teenage pop group would have to deal with. So I think that that's part of why they've mostly managed to kind of turn it into a success story, even though they haven't really been on the Hot 100 since the first album, or maybe
since 2000. I think the title track to this time around made a cameo. But yeah, so I was listening to a bunch of their albums today, and I've heard songs here and there from their last 20 years. And they're always consistently surprising in how good they are. They definitely sound like a fully realized band. They definitely sound like a band that knows who they are and has studied at the hands of some of the classic songwriting greats, and that they're pretty good at keeping the legacy alive themselves. And so you talked about some of these songs, some of the highlights from the latter part of their career, in your own article that you wrote for Billboard about the 11 best songs of theirs that aren't Mbop. Why don't you kind of pick a couple of those that you were the most fond of and talk about, like, what made them cool and what kind of showed different sides of them that people might not know from if they only know them from Mbop and those early singles?
Sure. I think The Walk was in 2004, and I was dating someone at the time who kept up with Hanson a little better than I did, and she played some of that, and I remember that song Running Man stuck out to me mm-hmm. a lot because it had a riff, and it was a little more of just kind of like a straight ahead like rock and roll song than they normally do, and it had that same kind of like indie Billy Joel kind of sound that Spoon has really like fine tuned over the last like 10 years. I mean, it's really funny how now, like, you know, I think I've mentioned this in the piece, but like Hanson probably jealous of Spoon's record sales at this point, and it's impossible to imagine that when, like, you know, Spoon came out with like a series of sneaks and was getting dropped by Matador.
Not many people have taken that bet.
Yeah, so. But yeah, Running Man is a really fun, unexpected song. I think it's Taylor sings really well on it. Let me think what else.
Well, I definitely want to hear you talk about Yearbook a little bit, even though that was from the first album, but it's still a pretty much a world removed from the singles. So why don't you talk about the mm-hmm. weird deep cut that is Yearbook?
Right. Yeah, I mean, Yearbook is far and away my favorite Hanson song. I think that, you know, it benefits from things that were sort of not just the fact that they were like this really confident band of songwriters, but also that sort of extra dimension of their age at the time where, you know, and I almost feel like middle of nowhere, I wish that it did more of this, because it doesn't really write about, or they didn't really write about the experience of being kids too much, but Yearbook is almost like, I mean, like, I can't think of, like, a specific analogy for, like, a show from the Disney Channel that would have had an episode like this where someone is doing, like, a whodunit to find them. Maybe even Pete and Pete, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. I could totally see, like, on The Adventures of Pete and Pete,
sure.
them doing an episode to find the kid who disappeared from the yearbook. But that's what the song is like. It makes a whole episode-long, melodrama out of where this kid from their class disappeared. And it's so funny, and it's really, you know, musically effective. It's incredible the way that he, you know, Taylor sings it totally earnestly, this really like slow pulsing ballad. You know, it starts out and you think it's going to be like No Doubt, like Don't Speak or Dream On by Aerosmith or something, and you know, and then it slowly, like, it comes out that it's, you know, just where did this kid Johnny from his class go? Like, it's just this weird little kid noir.
Yeah.
And at the same time, so brilliant. And then it just, you know, musically it just builds and builds, and it's got this like gorgeous breakdown with, you know, the group like layered to sound like a choir or something. I mean, it's not like, you know, that there were a lot of, you know, risks that they really should have like taken. Like, it's a like Middle of Nowhere is a solid record, and they're not really like a risk band. Like, they're ultimately just kind of like a good time like pop rock band, would have been really cool to see them develop that side of themselves. And it's weird because, apparently they hadn't even played that song live until the 10-year anniversary of that record. So you can tell that it really wasn't, like, their priority to do things like this. But it really shows a side of them that never fully developed. And it's really fascinating to listen to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was stunned by this song when I was listening to it, earlier this week. And, you know, it's kind of like their take on like a Diane Warren power ballad almost. But it's got these kind of noirish elements. It's very strange. My one problem with the song is that, you know, you're talking about like how it's cool to hear them talking about normal kid experiences. But they weren't really normal kids. I mean, they were homeschooled, so I don't know what they even know about yearbooks or like passing kids in the hallways or anything like that. So that's a little suspect. But regardless, we'll give them a pass on that one.
Yeah, I mean, that almost makes it like even funnier because like the fact that like, you know, for normal kids, this would not be like a weird occurrence for someone to just disappear from the yearbook. but to people who didn't experience yearbooks, maybe that's even funnier.
Yeah, the yearbook envy of Hanson. All right, thank you so much. Dan Weiss, freelancer, available for weddings and bar mitzvahs. Thanks for coming on the line, Dan.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Coming Around Again. We're still talking about Hanson's Mbop 20 years on. Next up, making our debut podcast appearance, we have Spin staff writer Anna Gatza. Are you excited, Anna?
I am thrilled.
All right. Well, thank you. So you wrote and did a really fun interview with Hanson that you did at South by Southwest, I guess last month. You talked about their career and their early days and kind of what it's like to still be together as a band of brothers after 20 years. But before we talk about that, I kind of want to get your background history with Hanson. So they were one of your first CDs, is that right?
I got 3 CDs for Christmas in probably the third grade, and it was Britney Spears, 98 Degrees, and Hanson.
Esteemed company.
Fantastic encapsulation of a time period. But that Hanson CD was not their debut album, Middle of Nowhere. It was their demos CD.
Even back then, yes. you're digging in the crates.
My aunt picked this for me. I didn't pick this at all. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting phenomenon because I'm sure that I had heard Mbop the pop song, but then I had the CD that had like the original sort of presented mm-hmm. package as being more authentic.
Yeah, so you got Hanson kind of like as the pure songwriters without all of the kind of the teen pop window dressing. And were you a fan of Hanson kind of stripped down and unplugged sort of?
As a kid, I'm sure I loved the pop and bop battle. That song was made for like children to love.
For sure. But by the time, you know, if you're getting them their CD bundled with CDs from Britney Spears and 98 Degrees, then it basically means that pop has already kind of moved on from Hanson. So, was this something that like you like kids your age were listening to at the time still? You're a couple years younger than I am, and I'm curious because I was on the young end for Hanson fans at the time. For people who are even younger, did this band already seem like a relic by the time that Britney and Backstreet came along?
I think you have your chronology off because to me the Backstreet Boys were so old that I didn't even know about them.
Wow,
they
really?
Were ancient. Yeah,
they were already old news at that point.
Like NSYNC were still current. But Backstreet Boys, I was like, I'm too young for that.
All right. But so when, you know, this opportunity presented itself 20 years later, were you still a fan of the band or were you just doing it out of kind of intellectual curiosity? What made you want to talk to them at South By?
Definitely more like intellectual curiosity and just seeing how, like, everything else about them aside, it is sort of impressive that 3 people who are siblings could still like each other and still be excited to write music together. Mm-hmm. So many years later, especially when you're not exactly an experimental or cutting edge, talent.
Right.
Yeah. They still find that there's value there to draw from.
Yeah, and definitely not what you would think of as a traditional South by Southwest band either. Although I guess if you talk to them, they come off like they think they're South by Old Salts by now. They're like, oh yeah, we're here every year, and
because that's
did
part
they
of
seem
their...
like kind of like they were holding court when you talked to them.
No, they're pretty chill. Mm-hmm. Dudes. I mean, it is a little bit, there's 3 of them and there's only 1 of me. So like, you know, the conversation balance is obviously mm-hmm. a little off in that respect, but they, you know, they don't seem, you know, they have a very, what seems like a very self-conscious, keeping it real persona.
And did they seem at home at South by Southwest? Did it seem like conspicuous at all for them to be there among all these kind of up and coming indie bands?
They do seem a little conspicuous because they're so well groomed, and again, there's three of them, and you know you can kind of tell they're related, and even if you don't know it's Hanson right away by looking at them, they have that thing where if you saw them on the sidewalk, you'd be like, that's a rock band.
Oh, really? So they still kind of have that aura about them 20 years later, even as they've kind of progressed into their
30s. It's the jackets and the jewelry, mm-hmm. and you don't see, most bands at South by, like, you know, just rolled out of their van in a t-shirt. Sure.
Are they still, like, dreamy?
This is something we've discussed privately.
Oh, yeah, hotly debated.
Well, when I was a kid in third grade, like, Taylor Hanson all the way, I thought he was the cute one.
Sure.
These days, personal opinion, Zach Hanson is
really
the more attractive of the three. But
Zach's overtaken Taylor on the leaderboard. That's funny. You know, we were talking with our producer Joey earlier, and he mentioned that, like, oh yeah, Hanson, like they were all like really good looking kids at the time, and I was like, well, kind of, but like really it was only Taylor, because you know Zach was kind of going through that awkward phase, and Isaac was like super young. Am I mixing it up? Actually, it was Isaac.
You're mixing it up. Zach is the young one. Yeah. So like.
Zach was a kid.
In my third grade perspective, was it like Taylor was a cute one, Isaac was a little bit more in the awkward pubescent stage, and then Zach was like so young, he was like, you know, my kid brother.
But now 20 years later, they've kind of leveled off.
They're all in their 30s now. Plus, they're all married, so this whole discussion is moot.
But yeah, so when you talk to them, they seem to kind of want to pronounce their own like normalcy. They seem to be very much like, this is who we are, this is who we've always been. There's even a line where they say to you in the interview that you should search out their old interviews because they promise that they're exactly the same. Does that match up with your kind of perception of them now versus then?
I didn't seek out any of their interviews that they did as children. I imagine not all of those are even online.
I would bet that Zach is a little bit less hyper these days, at the very least.
They're all very talkative and friendly, and they bounce off each other, and they don't interrupt each other until they really get excited. They've definitely been on a number of press junkets before.
Mm-hmm. So grooming tips aside, do they kind of seem like just like normal dudes at this point?
No, because they don't have normal jobs and normal lives.
That's true.
And so one of the things I was like made a point of asking them is, what would your careers be if you were not doing this? And I think most of us have sort of a backup career in mind, even mm-hmm. if we've been satisfied in our job for years and years. Like, we're sort of like, this is what I would go back to school to study, or like, and Hanson are not regular guys like
that.
They maybe have some ideas about what they would be doing were they not doing this, but it's not like, you know, they have a backup career or an alternate set of plans.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that I think has kind of continued to buy them a good amount of goodwill over the years, is that they do seem very sincere in that, like, the music is the thing. And that, like, this is all they are, this is all they can do. And, you know, despite the fact that they were, you know, teen pop sensations, and usually with that kind of comes the connotation of being, like, prepackaged or somehow calculated, that they basically just say, look, this is who we are. We're a brothers band. We play music. We love music, and we still love playing it. And there's even, I think maybe the funniest part in your interview is where I think Zach relates, like, a conversation he had with John Popper of Blues Traveler a number of years ago. We actually talked a lot about Blues Traveler in the first part of this interview. I guess Blues Traveler and Hanson are more closely linked than you'd think. But where John Popper basically says to them, like, you guys should sell your own lunchboxes. Like, why wouldn't you do this? You can make a lot of money. And they're like, well, you know, we could, I guess, but, like, we don't do that. We're not that kind of band.
Which is still, like, to them it seems so normal, but to me it is still insane that, like, a 12- and 14-year-old would even have a grasp on what...
Yeah, what, like, artistic integrity.
Like, what artistic integrity, you know, what serious, quote-unquote, or... like, committed bands do or do not do, because you don't understand that at 12 you want to buy the lunchbox.
Yeah, they may want one for themselves. Even if they don't want to sell it, they might need it to you know, for their home lunching.
But it does seem like the teen pop thing, not that they shouldn't have started so young because it's their lives and I can't tell them what to do, but sure. It does seem like the teen pop was like a fluke or like a detour, mm-hmm. and if they had developed as a more normal band and broken through at a more traditional age, that they would maybe be in that Blues Traveler realm of like stuff your dad likes.
Yeah, they'd be playing whatever the modern day equivalent of the Horde Festival is with Blues Traveler and Bare Naked Ladies and bands like that.
Yeah, or a band like Bare Naked Ladies, where you don't think about them, but you also haven't forgotten them.
Sure,
you don't take them seriously, but like if you ended up their show, you wouldn't be mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've transitioned into adulthood in a way that's kind of, it's interesting because, you know, they never had scandal, they never had any kind of media blow-ups, and they never did anything that like was like a conscious like shunning of their earlier selves, their earlier careers, earlier music, anything like that. What you get is these kind of like half measures, things like, you know, in your interview they make kind of a PG-rated sex joke about how they enjoy like practice procreating.
They're very PG-rated, and I like, we didn't talk about it in the interview, but I do have the sense just coming off them that they're like Christian,
mm-hmm.
and that's, I would imagine, part of what has kept their family bond so close and kept them like working together, and you know, something that's brought them together. Yeah. Over all this time.
Not Mormon, though. They go to great lengths to point out they are, in fact, not Mormon. But and that's another interesting thing about them when you talk about their family, is that you never really hear, as part of the Hanson origin story, like the parents don't really play that large of a role. I mean, they'll always say, like, yeah, our parents helped instill our work ethic, or their, you know, our parents have been very supportive, but they don't play the role of like the domineering child star parents that you kind of expect with kids that get so famous at such a young age.
I don't know how to separate whether how much of that is a very smart, compelling press story versus how much of that could be true, because you also imagine that after M-Bop, like just a few years after, I'm sure they had people in their ear being like, you need to reboot.
Sure.
You need to try something else. And we can all think of, you know, teen stars who attempted comebacks and, you know, saw really unfortunate, embarrassing results, and they didn't fall prey to that, which means they had the wherewithal to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder if that same strategy is like how they handled their parents and were like, this is what we're doing, you know, you can't tell us what to do, just support us, or whether there's some other kind of story that they're just covering with that story.
And that's entirely possible, but at the very least, you don't hear anything about, like, you know, I remember, you know, when Justin Bieber got really famous, you would hear stories of his super religious mother kind of, and not necessarily hectoring him, but kind of like staying on him to keep along the righteous path. And she got upset at some of like the people that he worked with early in his career, and some of the decisions that he made. And, you know, maybe that's just a result of, you know, the media being so much more pervasive in 2010 than it was in 1997. But Hanson kind of did well, I think, to sort of, you know, keep their family separate from, despite the fact that they are a family act. They did a good job of making their music the story, as opposed to like what was going on in their personal situation.
And so you get some of that narrative with like Katy Perry too,
sure.
of like
yeah.
a religious person who like left the faith and had family pushback from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think that maybe the subtext of the Hanson story is that they didn't leave the faith. That I imagine they still all go to church together.
It's entirely possible.
Yeah.
with their 12 little ones in tow.
Yes, with their 12,
yeah.
their collective 12 children.
I think the first one, the last one actually came out last year even. They still make headlines whenever they get a new kid.
You say came out like it's an album?
That kid dropped last year.
It's a child.
Yeah, so do you think that Hanson have any kind of particular relevance to music in 2017? Is there a band that you see kind of either creating their model musically or following down their general career path, or like who's the living embodiment of the Hanson spirit in 2017, if there is such a thing?
That's hard to say, but just because they're in the news this week, like Haim leaps to mind.
Okay.
As another example of a sibling trio, and not, but Haim would be an example of someone who, they didn't come break through as child stars. Like, they're not like Smoosh. They waited until a more traditional age. They probably were more fully developed as people and as songwriters, and have certainly a more adult audience. And they've mm-hmm. captured this audience that will probably stick with them in a way that the M-Bop audience, you know, the number one hit audience, did not stay through to the present day.
Yeah, that's true. We were talking about it on the earlier part of the podcast about how, you know, their Billboard fortunes fell off kind of very quickly, very precipitously. But they do still have, you know, they still sell at shows pretty much wherever they go. It seems like, I remember reading that they caused a riot at a show a couple years ago because, you know, too many people came to it. And I was actually, I was you know, kind of messing around on YouTube the other day, and I saw that One Direction, in fact, have covered M-Bop as kind of like a sound check at live shows. It's kind of like an interstitial thing, like, oh, let's pay it back to the legacy. Let's let these kids know what Hanson was about back in the day. And that makes me happy. And perhaps the lasting legacy of Hanson in 2017 is Mhop, their recently released IPA, which is still along the same sort of lines of their kind of half step into adulthood, where it's like it would have been considered scandalous maybe as kids for them to release their own beer, but as adults, it seems like kind of the safest, dangerous thing they can possibly do.
Oh, this is absolutely one of the jokes I said in the interview is like, you know, we don't do anything bad, we don't do any drugs, we just drink beer.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is the edgiest part of Hansen, is that it's like an IPA instead of like a regular ale.
Yeah, it's not even like a frat boy beer. It's like a beer for distinguished beer drinkers.
So one of the parts of the interview that was cut because it was sort of a total digression.
All right, we're going to get the outtakes. Yeah, let's have it.
Is that I asked them to talk to me, like explain the beer to me because I haven't tried it. So I wanted them to sort of give me the rundown. And they talked about it as being like, it's like an everyday drinker. They keep it on their tour bus so they can just head off stage, get in the bus, you know, crack open a beer. They want this nice, mellow, like not crazy hoppy IPA.
So the beer is mostly for their own consumption. If other people happen
and
to
their
drink
festival,
it,
they have a festival,
right?
The beer
right,
festival,
yes, the beer festival.
And I'm sure you can buy. I need to try it. Somebody send me some, please.
To commemorate you making your first ever podcast appearance, I you know, the next case is on me.
Andrew will buy me a Hansen IPA. After I talked to them like the next week, I looked it up on Beer Advocate, and it has a pathetic rating.
Oh,
people
really
think this beer sucks.
Sorry, all right, well, Hansen. I'm sure there's a lot of people that think that Hansen's music sucks, but you know, they keep making it and they keep selling their IPA, and they seem to be living a pretty good life.
They are living their dream, which is, I'm happy it's still working for them. And then you were saying they still sell out shows and stuff, and it's part of what they're selling is like the dream that nothing can change.
That's a good note to end on. Thank you so much for coming on, Anna. It's been great.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.